From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. You know, the Underground Railroad was not a real railroad. There were no chugging engines, there were no steel tracks, but there are both of those things in author Colson Whitehead's latest novel. In his book, many historical details about that era are reimagined, and the route to freedom begins in Georgia. The Underground Railroad has won over the attention of critics, Oprah's Book Club, and the National Book Awards, and there's even talk about adapting it into a short-run television series. Colson Whitehead is in Atlanta tomorrow night at the Carter Center, and he joins me now. Good morning.
Hey, howdy.
It's good to have you. You know, the last book I read of yours was about flesh-eating zombies, so imagine my surprise to go the other way and still find a dystopian America.
Yeah, well, you know, I try to mix it up from book to book. So Zone 1, the book about zombies, came out a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And that was sort of depressing. Everyone's dead. And then my last book was a humor book about the World Series of Poker. So I seem to vacillate between being horribly pessimistic and then kind of optimistic.
Well, I'm going to try to get to this whole interview and reveal no spoilers, but I wonder what you brought with you from that the world of zombies that you imagined to this one, because we're talking about two relatively imagined landscapes.
Sure, but you know there is overlap. You know, in a apocalyptic story, a book or a film, you have survivors, and they're trying to get to the last human settlements. Without that hope that there's a place of refuge, a place of safety, what's the point of going on? And, you know, there are always setbacks, and you get to a new place, and things fall apart. But you hope that over the next ridge, over the next hill, there's a place of safety. And, you know, and that's the structure of a slave narrative. You're going from refuge to refuge, hoping to get north. And in the midst of the hell you've been born into, you have to have that hope that there is safety in New York, Massachusetts, Canada, and that hope animates your journey.
I want to listen to actually Laura Smalley. She was born in slavery on a plantation in Texas, and she did an oral history interview in 1941 in which she's talking about watching one of the older women on her plantation being whipped while her hands and legs are tied around a peach tree. It's a bit difficult to understand the audio, but take a listen.
Well, she couldn't do nothing but just kick her feet, you know, just kick her feet. But it just had her clothes all down to her waist, you know. Well, he whipped her so then at night they had to grease her back. Grease her back. I don't know what kind of grease they had, but they sure grease her back. Late that evening, they gave her dinner. Eat late that evening. Well, she said, whooped so bad then, you know, she didn't want to eat, you know. If you put whoop you half a day, you ain't want to eat.
So what slave narratives did you consult? Because you clearly did a lot of research, even though the places are not entirely based on historic detail, but what slave narratives did you read?
Yeah, you know, I was inspired by the more famous ones I read in college. You know, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Jacobs. Harriet Jacobs was a woman who ran away from her master when she, hit teenage years and became an object of sexual desire, and hid in an attic for 7 years, waiting for a passage outside of North Carolina. So that is definitely an inspiring chorus story in my book. And then, you know, I'm not sure if that clip you just you played was from the WPA collection from the 1930s. But in the Great Depression, the Works Progress Administration sent out writers to interview former slaves, people who had been kids or teenagers at the time of the Civil War, and there are hundreds of these oral accounts of people's lives, and some of them are just about farming, the very mundane. Some of them are about master-slave relationships, and you know, and together they present a huge portrait of slave life: small farms, big plantations, and it allowed me the freedom to come up with my own plantation for the book.
I read that you actually got the idea for this. First thought to yourself, gee, what if the Underground Railroad were an actual railroad in 2001, but waited 15 years to write it? Why?
Well, I knew when I had the idea that I wasn't ready. I thought, you know, I was 30, and I thought if I had more life experience, if I had some more books under my belt, I might be able to, you know, to tackle the idea and do the justice that it deserved. So whenever I finished a book, I would put out my notes and think, am I ready? And then realize I wasn't.
What made this book so difficult?
Slavery, you know, I mean, you know, it's a hard topic to wrap your head around. You know, I think we have one idea of how bad it was, and then once you go into the research and the oral testimony, you realize it's even much, much worse than you imagined, and it had to be. How do you keep millions of people from running away from the plantation? You instill fear, you torture them, you mentally destroy them. And so I had to wait till I was ready and capable of doing the story justice.
But you also said you didn't want to write the novel of Southern black misery. So you read all this stuff about the horrors of slavery, which, as you say, are beyond imagining. But you didn't want to make the book miserable.
Well, I think, you know, that's a quote about how I feel about certain kinds of stereotypical narratives. And so, you know, when I started, I was a very self-conscious person, and I didn't want to write, when I started writing in the 90s, I didn't want to write the Gen X novel of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I didn't want to write that autobiographical first novel. That seemed very obvious. And being from New York, I couldn't relate to, you know, certain Southern novels that were outside of my experience. And so, you know, I've always tried to tackle subjects from a different perspective. And so my first book was about social uplift using the metaphor of elevators. And then this novel hopefully gets to a deeper truth about race and slavery and American history. But of course, the vehicle is a, you know, the childish idea that the Underground Railroad is a real thing. And so I'm always coming at things from a different perspective, and hopefully, you know, that allows people to see things from a different angle.
I'm speaking with Colson Whitehead. His latest novel is called The Underground Railroad, and he reimagines that route that carried perhaps 100,000 slaves or more to freedom in the North. Colson's in Atlanta tomorrow night for a reading and book signing at the Carter Center, and he joins me on the line. It's good to talk to you.
My pleasure.
So it feels like, I mean, the book felt to me, I'm struggling because I don't want to give away any spoilers, but it felt to me almost as one of those almost Greek odysseys. And in every case, when you went to a different state, and what you were describing was, it kind of came upon me slow, how different it was from what really happened. That, I have to say, was pretty successful at making me rethink a story that I knew really, really well. How did you decide on the character of each of these states? Because they start in Georgia, they go through South Carolina, and they go through, I mean, Tennessee especially, very, very different. How did you make those choices?
Yeah, well, you know, I was thinking about it in the back of my head, you know, for many, many years. And, yeah, without going too much into it, you know, I was borrowing a structure from the Odyssey, from Gulliver's Travels, Pilgrim's Progress, you know, all those sort of older stories where a voyager is tested island to island, state to state, in a series of allegorical trials. And so the book is being rebooted every 60 pages as we go to a different state. And there's a different sort of alternative America, an America that might have been. And, you know, and I think for many years, the states were vastly different. One took place in the future. Another was a sort of blasted wasteland. And then as I was trying to figure out how to use my fantastic effects in the book, it seemed just telling it straight in the language and technology of 1850 and keeping Core's experience foregrounded would be the most efficient way of weaving in all these sort of deformations of reality that are in the book.
There's one part, and I wanted to read this quote from it, where you say, quote, "The conflict in Europe was terrible and violent," she told her sailor, "but she took exception to the name, the Great War." The Great War had always been between the white and the black. It would always be. So you also move World War I to the time frame of the mid-19th century. Why?
In order to enlarge the conversation of what has changed and what hasn't changed in terms of race in America, I mean, yeah, that section is a flash forward. And so one of the people who is a young child in 1850 grows yeah. up and has a different sort of life. But by, once I make the decision to make the Underground Railroad literal, I'm freed from reality. And my rule was, I'm not going to stick to the facts, but I'm going to stick to the truth. And the truth of race in America is that oppression doesn't end with the end of the Civil War. It doesn't end with Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, and it doesn't end with a black president. It's a continuing struggle between the races, between the white and the black, and everybody to come to a better understanding than we've had for centuries.
I have to ask you about this thing I read in the acknowledgments, because you wrote, David Bowie is in every book, and I always put on Purple Rain and Daydream Nation when I write the final pages. Is that literal? Do you really listen to those albums while you're writing?
I'm from New York, and there's always noise, and so that's, I don't write in the silent room. I have a playlist of 2,000 songs, and
it's like your writing playlist.
Yeah, and you know, it goes from Fat Boy Slim, The Public Enemy, to Peggy Lee, to The Cramps, and it keeps me company. You know, I grew up in New York. There's always noise. There's always some siren. Somebody's screaming upstairs, and so I'm used to, having that company. And whenever I get to the final page, like the last day of work in that final draft, or that first draft, I put on Purple Rain, Sonic Youth, State of the Nation, and I know that I've finally made it through to the other side. I wasn't hit by a bus while I was writing. I only have a few more hours of work, and those albums lift me up.
Okay, so let me get back to the actual novel itself. I just had to take that little... Although, if you want to send me the playlist of 2,000 songs, I would totally listen to that, and maybe I'll become a famous novelist. You also talked about the difference over the course of 15 years of becoming a parent possibly made it possible for you to write this book, and so much of this book is based on parenthood and the loss of a child, including the final spoiler, which I will not in any way, shape, or form reveal. But what changed for you when you became a parent?
Well, I think, when you think about slavery or contemplate it, it's one thing, like when you see Roots when you're 8, like I was. Another thing when you study it in college. When you're older and if you have kids, at least for me, I was awakened, to a new empathy, in becoming a parent, and you realize what it is to see your wife, your son, your daughter whipped in front of you. You realize what it is to see a relative sold down south to a harsher system, a harsher plantation. And, for me, when I had the idea at 30, I wasn't emotionally ready, I think, to deal with the material. And, I'm glad I waited 16 years to become a more mature and, hopefully wiser person. I think if you stick at something over the years, you get better. So I've become a better writer. And if you, and hopefully we're all more mature than we were 15 years ago. That's one of my small hopes, is that all of us get better with age, hopefully.
You may not be able to make that assumption, but you may, if I'm going to go by what you said earlier, then your next book is going to be a humor book about cats, right? I mean, the next one's going to be funny?
Some cats, some clowns,
Wait, don't say clowns. We're having problems with clowns in the South.
Yeah. So, I think like most people, I have, pessimistic and optimistic trajectories in my personality. And you keep writing books and you get to address different interests. And I like post-apocalyptic fiction. I like dealing with history. And so you keep working, you get to tackle different things.
Does it make it sustainable, though? I mean, we've got about 30 seconds left. Does it make it more sustainable that you go from one serious to more one lighthearted one?
It seems to work. And, if you're dealing with terrible material, that's really hard. Having a book that's full of jokes or is lighthearted definitely takes the edge off.
That is author Colson Whitehead. He is author of the book The Underground Railroad, among with many others. Colson, it's a pleasure.
Oh, thanks a lot.
The state of Georgia has declared 2016 the year of Georgia music. So every month, there's a celebration of the people who make the state's soundtrack, basically. On Second Thought is part of that year-long jam session, and we're going to bring you conversations all year long with and about musicians of the Peach State. So today, we have a pair of singer-songwriters who were both born and raised right here in Georgia. Michelle Malone comes from a generation of performers. Actually, she was born and raised right here in Atlanta. Hello.
Hello.
And also with us is Randall Bramblett, who was born in Jessup and now lives in Athens. Good morning, Randall.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. It's good to have you both. Randall and Michelle will both perform tomorrow night in Atlanta at the Callenwald Fine Arts Center. It's part of the Georgia Department of Economic Development Explore Georgia Songwriter Series. Wow, they could have come up with a shorter title. I wanted to start, and Michelle, let me ask you this question first. I wanted to start with this title of singer-songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't seem to have a great definition of it. It seems odd when they're calling Katy Perry, for example, a singer-songwriter to me. That's not what I think of. What is a singer-songwriter to you?
I think it's just a way to break it down to the most basic description, like, food.
it doesn't really mean anything.
We write our own songs and we sing them and perform them. So, yes, it is accurate. It's not incredibly descriptive. It does denote an air of, say, a James Taylor type
thing. Yeah, or Woody Guthrie.
Woody Guthrie. All great, great people, artists. I think what I do covers more of the spectrum than that. And I think Randall would say the same thing about himself.
Randall, would you say the same thing about yourself?
Yeah, I think so. I usually think of singer-songwriters as people that can do solo shows, you know. I don't know if Katy Perry does solo shows, but in small rooms.
No, she needs people in shark costumes.
But I think of, people that are singer-songwriters are people that can do these little small acoustic shows and focus on their songs, because almost everybody, even in the big bands, write their own songs, you know, so... I mean, Michelle and I both play in bands, and, we're still singer-songwriters, I guess, but we do a lot of solo shows, too.
Well, let me introduce, for those who have not heard your stuff, let me introduce them both to you. Let's begin with you, Randall. This is the title track off a 2015 album. It's called Devil Music. This is like old school stuff, Randall. Who were you listening to when you were young?
I was listening to blues and R&B mostly when I was, and whatever was on the radio, you know, like the rest of us, whatever came down the pike on the radio, on the AM radio from Jacksonville. That's where we got most of our information. And then I discovered WLAC in Nashville, which was playing late night, gospel and black sermonettes and blues. And that's what really grabbed me, I think, at a deep level. And that's where that song comes from.
It's the about devil
Howlin'
music.
Wolf. That's about Howlin' Wolf meeting his mama again. And didn't work out too good, but she didn't like the devil music. But he can't stop playing it. It all seems connected to me somehow.
Okay, and now let's introduce everyone to Michelle's music. This is the song called Feather in a Hurricane. You told our producers that you often close out your shows with this one. How come?
Live we do it a lot faster.
Oh, really?
And a lot more intensely, I'd like to say, because it is faster, and it just seems to be everybody's favorite song. And I like to end shows on a high note and leave people feeling good and bopping their heads.
High note, although the image of being in a feather in a hurricane is a little bit distressing.
Exactly. Well, life is a little stressful, so...
Okay, we've got a couple minutes left, and I wanted Randall to get to this idea of writing this music. Have you ever written for someone else other than yourself?
I have tried a few times, but it usually works. It has worked better for me to just concentrate on writing a good song, and then if somebody hears it and picks it up, that's the way it works best for me. Every time I try to write for somebody else, it doesn't feel real or authentic mm-hmm. to me, so it doesn't work as well.
You're agreeing with that. You don't write for other people?
No, I totally agree with Randall. It feels like manufactured and not from your spirit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I've never written any music, but yeah.
Well, it's one thing if you're writing with another person and that person, you know, puts their thumbprint on it and then they go on to record it or perform it. And a lot of times other folks, they can write for other people just fine, but I have not had success with it. It never really feels, like you said, it doesn't feel authentic.
How's that different from, say, performing somebody else's tune that they've written?
You got to pick the right song that feels authentic to you, and then it's fine.
There you go. There you go.
Michelle and I wrote a song recently, didn't we?
Michelle. We sure did. I keep threatening to learn the darn thing so I can play it out. It's so good, Randall. And
I play it
in mornings when I get
What's
up.
What's the name of the song?
Fox and the Hound.
Oh, yeah, The Fox and the Hound.
Yep.
If I were a river, you were a storm, I would mm-hmm. rock you and roll you to the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah,
it's real good.
Do you perform it already? That sounds great.
I perform it right now in my living room, trying to remember it and figure out what key to do it in and all the minor details.
We are going
to
continue.
A few things to work out yet.
We are going to continue this conversation. My guests are Georgia songwriters Michelle Malone and Randall Bramblett. I wanted to move on to the sound of Georgia, if there is such a thing, because a lot of people talk about the sound of the South and also the sound of Georgia, and yet if you add up our big names from Ray Charles to the B-52s to R.E.M. to Outkast, those are not the same sounds. So does our state, and let me go to you first, Randall, does our state have a sound?
It's a broad sound if it does, because there's such a huge difference in all this stuff, and I don't know if it... I think the South definitely has a way of creeping into everybody's music, but the music itself is very, different. You got Widespread Panic and all these different, jam bands and country music and rap. But I think, it's hard not to have the South creep in. So there's something that connects, but it's pretty broad.
What is it, Michelle? What connects the music from Georgia?
I feel like it's an attitude, and I feel like it's an attitude of, I'm going to write a song, I'm going to perform a song the way it makes me happy, the way it makes me feel good, and I don't necessarily need to adhere to what everyone else is doing. I think it's that Southern rebellion that comes in and allows us to do, as an artist, to create what makes us happy and really turns us on. We follow our bliss because we are basically rebellious as Southerners.
I want to play.
You like that, Randall?
I like it.
I'm
going
to start a class.
I want to play a couple songs that you both said were inspirations for you. And Randall, let's hear some James Brown first. Mm. Here is Cold Sweat.
Mm.
Your past. I just want
Okay, recorded before I was born. What about this caught your attention?
Rhythm.
Oh, man. The rhythm in his voice and everything about it so tight. I heard him in Waycross, Georgia when I was in high school. Must have been my senior year because somehow I got in there. But, man, it's
Did your mom know you were going to go see James Brown?
I don't remember. Maybe not. But a group of us somehow got over there to this municipal auditorium, I think it was. But, you know, it was life-changing. This is new music and revolutionary music to me. The funk of it all and the tightness of it all and his voice is just, man, it brings a whole world of new stuff to, I mean, at that time it was totally new.
He was such a great singer, too, and people often overlook that.
Yeah.
Because the music is so tight and just makes you feel you got
to
move.
When you listen to A Man's World, any of the ballads he sings, what a singer he was.
And he wrote all these.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let's hear another band that really could play and has played for hours. The Georgia Satellites. Here is Red Light. Okay, so we should have Michelle's mic on. She was in here rocking out and singing along with that. Why did you like the Georgia Satellites? Why do you still love this music?
You know, I don't know. I stumbled upon them. I was a teenager sneaking into bars in Buckhead, and there was a little club called Hedgens, and I would sneak in to see them every chance I could. Anytime they played, I was there, you know. They just did the real thing, and they tore it up, and they played for hours, and they played Chuck Berry, and then they had these original songs like that, and I remember them playing Keep Your Hands to Yourself, and I'd be singing it for days after seeing them, and nobody knew who they were, and they were the Georgia Rolling Stones to me, you know?
All right, so let's hear from a woman that, Michelle, you said actually inspired some of your guitar playing.
Oh, yeah.
This is Carolyn Aiken, and this is Day by Day.
And this cold steel under my fingers, how did we ever get this far?
So what do you like about her guitar playing?
Oh, she is such a great guitarist. She's technically proficient, but she brings so much soul and passion, and she has such an individualistic way of playing guitar. I can't think of anyone else that plays guitar like she does. And she introduced me to open tunings and a style that I wasn't familiar with when I was first coming up, you know, and it made a huge impression on me, and we get to play together to this day, and I'm always honored to be on stage.
She's in her 60s, still playing from Atlanta.
She's better than ever, and she's a great singer, and she's a great songwriter. So, she's always blown me away.
She's great.
Yeah, so we've got about a minute left, and Randall, let's go back to you and go back to this idea of a songwriter, somebody who both sings and songwrites. How does that change your performance? Do you think? Is there a difference between you doing your own tune and doing someone else's?
Well, you know, when you write a song, you put everything you got into it and you spend all this time on it and trying to make it right and make it feel right and make it mean something. So by the time you get through, hopefully you can sing the thing with passion and you love it. You know, doing covers is fun too, though. I mean, there's so many great songs out there. It's fun to do covers, but when you're doing something you've created yourself, it just seems to mean a little more, I think, because you're putting yourself out there and you've spent so much time putting it together.
That is Randall Bramblett, Michelle Malone as well, both singer-songwriters, and you can actually hear them together in Atlanta at the Callenwald Fine Arts Center. This will be the third installment of the Explore Georgia Songwriter Series produced by Georgia Tourism. More information about that can be found at gppnews.org. Michelle and Randall, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
This is wonderful.
Great being with you.
That's our show for today. You can be part of the Year in Georgia Music. Just tell us who your favorite Georgia musician is that maybe we don't hear enough about. Call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us. This is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley.